I do my show on the Heritage Radio Network because I think it's important to talk about the impact of technology on our lives.
I do my show to reach home cooks and help them do better.
Because I love getting together with people in the industry.
I like hosting my show because, to me, it's the stories about people and their relationship to food that help make the food more interesting and more delicious.
Our hosts do their shows as a labor of love, but we still need your financial support in order to keep the lights on and keep the tape rolling. Please become a member today at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's July 12, 2016. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 and the Good Beer Seal. Hey, it's Happy July Good Beer Month. We've been working on that for a number of years. And we're very happy to have author and brewer Derek Dallinger, who's got a new book coming out, The Fermented Man. We also know him as the brewer for Kent Files Brewery from Connecticut, which we like a lot. Ambassador, how are you? Nice to see you.
So good to see you. I feel like I haven't seen you guys for ages.
It's like summer, you know?
I know. People are good.
And Will Stevens from beermanies.com.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Congratulations, man. You're a certified Cicerone.
See, I told you you'd do it. No problems.
not too long ago, the three of us, Ann, Will, and I traveled to Pennsylvania, and we got to interview Bill Kovaleski at Victory the night before they announced it. They're emerging with Southern Tier. So that was kind of a special journey. I think it took us 6 hours round trip. Well, we got stuck in, there was a tree down, there were on trains, there was snow.
Yeah, and then we had our beer and we had our ribs that we took to go from the beer dinner because we couldn't stay. And we, you know, all class. That's how we
good
roll.
Time. So yeah. We bonded and everything. But Derek, let's cut to the chase. So I know you're on Ferment About It not too long ago. Let's talk about your book first, because it's pretty interesting. So what, you lived on fermented food and drink only for a year?
Yep, nothing but fermented food for an entire year. Not the easiest diet, and not a diet I did to convince anyone else to follow it, not going on to Oprah to sell the all-fermented food diet. It was, you know, a way of kind of drawing people's attention to the variety of fermented foods available and illustrating the fact that fermentation pretty much reaches through every type of food and drink you could think of.
What were the main, in terms of foods, what were the main foods that you ate during that time?
Well, I certainly ate a lot of bread and cheese. We got a lot of calories from bread, cheese, beer, yogurt, and of course, you know, you can ferment pretty much any vegetable, although vegetables don't have a lot of calories, so living off of sauerkraut is rather challenging. Cured meats. I mean, it's really interesting that just how much food is encompassed within fermentation that people don't think of. Like meat, especially, people are kind of perplexed when I tell them that, you know, I could eat any fermented meat at all, and then you point out that pepperoni and salami and prosciutto and all these really fancy gourmet foods are fermented. So, you know, I had a surprising amount of variety available to me, which was, of course, the point.
Take us from the beginning. How did this start? Where did it come from? Where did the idea originate?
You know, my mind just works in weird ways is pretty much where the idea came from. I was learning about fermentation, really getting into fermentation. I had been a home brewer for a couple of years and really getting into sour beer early on and getting obsessed with, you know, Brettanomyces and wild yeast and bacteria. So I was familiar with lactobacillus bacteria from brewing and from making sour beer. And shopping really just at the natural food markets and kind of looking at all these other, you know, local Hudson Valley made fermented foods. And it, you know, I realized like, oh, wow, the same species of bacteria or same genus of bacteria makes so many different foods, which I found kind of mind boggling. And that just kind of, you know, that awareness accumulated until I realized there really is so much fermented food out there that you could probably live off of fermented food. And that idea just kind of popped into my head as like a wacky writer idea sort of thing, like something I could make a joke about. But I really was fascinated by that concept and by the potential of fermentation and fermentation as this thing is finally being restored to our culture that we lost for decades. How much was out there that we'd been eating for thousands of years that people kind of have forgotten
so
about?
You never had like a raw vegetable or a piece
the
of
whole
lettuce.
Year? Yeah, no raw vegetables.
I was gonna say when you don't look so good, but I'm just joking. But you look great, man.
Yeah, it's probably all the non-fermented.
You know, we
food
kept walking in because I've met you once or twice, and we were like, we know he has a beard, and every guy became a reverse. We called out this one guy, Derek, and his girlfriend started joking him. But I'm kind of excited to meet you. You know, it's like when you read about someone that. Remember, there was a guy that lived for 40 days on beer alone.
Right.
That seemed more extreme.
I think that would be harder. I mean, the less variety you have access to, the more challenging a diet is, of course. And even the limitations in what I could eat with the fermented diet were extremely challenging. And, even with the variety of foods I could eat, which, spanned every type of food that there is, it still takes this psychological toll on you when you're like, I've eaten cheese every day this week. I've eaten bread every day this week. And usually nothing elaborate. Like usually I would just eat things kind of as they were. So it takes this weird psychological toll where you're like, I'm just eating cheese again. I'm just eating bread again. I'm just drinking beer and getting calories from beer again. So I can imagine more than a couple of days on nothing but beer.
Did you lose weight?
I lost a few pounds, yeah, and that certainly wasn't the goal of it. But any limited diet like that, you're probably going to lose a little weight. But I checked in with the doctor, made sure my vitals were healthy, and my blood pressure actually went down, and I did lose a few pounds, but actually felt surprisingly good throughout the year.
And where do you live? Do you live in New York City? Because even now, I feel like it's. You go to the fresh bread section and you look at the ingredients and it's not a fermented long fermentation
right.
bread. I mean, it's hard to find. Where
it's
did you find all this?
So
food?
Hard to find. Yeah. Bread is, I mean, I kind of, the bread chapter in here is probably the most negative chapter in the book where I really kind of complain about the state of American bread. It hasn't been restored to what it was the way that say craft beer is restored the essence of beer and cheese and all these other gourmet foods. Bread, I think, is still lagging behind, and I think people maybe misidentify what went wrong with bread. And it's very multifaceted. Like to make what I at least personally consider a really good loaf of bread is very complicated and involves not just an artisan making it by hand, but properly milled flour, whole wheat, and sourdough fermentation.
Long fermentation, exactly.
So a lot of bread gets one or two of those things right, but not all of them. And I had lived in the city for a few years, but when I was doing this diet, I'd been up in the Hudson Valley for a few years at that point. I kind of fled Brooklyn to make more room for my homebrewing exploits. So I was in Beacon, New York, and there are some artisanal food stores there.
There's a great cheese shop up there too. That in Hudson.
Yeah, the Hudson Valley is awesome and really is kind of on the forefront of the agricultural and culinary world, at least compared to a lot of the country. But even there, it's certainly challenging, especially with things like bread, where just there are bread makers, but they're not really making the types of bread that I was looking for.
And it can't be a coincidence, too, the crazy gluten allergies and the celiac and all of these things coming and gluten being demonized, but it's not
exactly.
The gluten. It's
right. And I think
the
a lot of
misshaping, right? Of the
yeah.
Gluten.
What changed is, we used to make bread a very different way, and fermentation tends to break down foods and makes them more digestible and easier for our bodies to process. And when we stopped, fermenting bread for more than a couple hours, that's a huge change, and that's a huge effect on how our body is able to process that food.
Do you feel the same way about when you brew? Do you feel like that you have to give your beers time?
Well, it certainly helps. I mean, I guess it depends what types of beer you're doing. And I have a lot of interest in so-called clean beers that are just fermented with ale yeast and only take 2 or 3 weeks to ferment. So I don't know that there's those are certainly not rushed or by any means. To make a comparison between bread, wild ales, sour beers that age for a lot longer, that age for months or years, are broken down quite a bit more and possibly easier to digest or process for our bodies. And I actually did a little bit of research on that during this, and it's hard to study the human gut and draw exacting conclusions about what's going on in there. It's a major field of research right now. There's a lot of study being done on our, you know, on our microbiome and our relationship with the microbes in our gut. So far, like, no hard conclusions, really. It's really hard to say what exactly happens when you introduce any one element into your gut. It's such a complicated ecosystem. Any single change can have these myriad ramifications. So there's a lot of complexity there that still needs a lot of study.
Will, have you ever had any experiments like this? I mean, you ever, like, go on a fast? I mean, I went on, like, a vision quest when I was 21 and only had, like, soup and bread for a week, but nothing like a year.
Some of my favorite beer fasting events for lunch are sour events where you're drinking dozens of sour beers on one day, and it definitely does wonders to the stomach.
Yeah.
It's definitely a good test of your stomach.
Yeah.
But also the flavors, too. And I think it's so funny. In New York especially, I find, like, because we have limited space and our kitchen space isn't that, you know, ample. So a lot of people are using more of the fermented techniques, kimchi, things that don't need to be stored. We don't need a freezer for or refrigeration. Do you think there's any, where do you think we are as a country in terms of those flavors? Because there's, for everybody that loves it, there's always like, oh, my God, what is this? This is sour. You know, it's still that kind of stigma about a sour food or drink,
right?
You know, what have you seen?
Well, I mean, it's interesting how beer always seems to be at the forefront of these things. And, you know, that's great. I think beer is going to change or help to change a lot of the, you know, the culinary setbacks in America kind of accidentally. Like, the fact that sour beer has become such a craze and so popular in the craft beer world is actually a great thing just for, you know, our general eating habits and health, because, yeah, for a while, you know, people just didn't like sour flavors or thought they didn't like sour flavors. So things that had a tang or tartness to them would be, you know, kind of shunned. But now that so many beer geeks, at least, are geeking out about sour flavors, hopefully that helps to normalize things like a lot of these fermented foods. And, you know, it might be an acquired taste, but, you know, more people will learn
what,
to.
What about in your gut? Like, you know, Will, you're in Belgium visiting some sour breweries. I mean, there are some truths to food and beer pairings. You know, certain beers complement. Do you think that certain sour beers help you digest, like, a fatty food better or help balance out a spicy food?
I would think there's, you know, some likelihood that's true. Again, I don't, you know, I tried to do a little bit of research in this, and the results were, you know, inconclusive, I guess you could say, because it's so complicated. It seems like that would probably be likely, but it's, you know, it's something that I'll leave to people who are more scientifically minded than me, because
feels that way at least. Helps me digest cheese.
Well, this guy's the fermented man. It's like the marathon man, the bionic. He's transformed himself. And through that, I'm sure you feel like you became a better brewer. And
I think so, yeah. You become more comfortable with certainly wild fermentation and experiments. And one of the experiments that I write about in the book, in the beer chapter, I noticed that a lot of starchy vegetable ferments would develop pellicle, which, as a home brewer, I was very familiar with what a pellicle is. To other fermenters, to veggies.
What is it?
Oh,
right?
Sorry. Pellicle is kind of like a colony of yeast and bacteria, forms like a bubbly moon landscape surface over the top of the beer. I mean, it looks like this crazy sheen of these weird white bubbles and veins, and it's quite hard to describe, but I highly recommend for anyone that doesn't know what a pellicle is that's listening to just Google, you know, Google image search pellicle.
And figure out how to spell it and then Google it.
P-E-L-L-I-C-L-E. Yeah, there you go.
Cool.
So it's well worth seeing what these things look like. And they would appear on these starchy vegetable ferments that I did, like potatoes and squash and pumpkin, which have a lot of these more complex sugars for this complex colony. I mean, similar, I guess, in concept to like a SCOBY, a symbiotic colony of bacteria and yeast that you'd find on kombucha or vinegar. Very different in appearance, but kind of same concept, where these yeast and bacteria form an actual physical membrane on the surface.
And then quickly, what are we drinking?
That is...
You're also the brewer at Ken Falls.
Yes.
All over the place.
We love Ken
author
Falls.
How long have you been the brewer at Ken Falls?
Yeah, I keep myself quite busy. Ken Falls opened last year, so we brewed the first batch in February of 2015. So it's been about a year and a half.
What are we drinking right now?
So that is Fleur de l'Amour. It is a wild ale, a sour beer we brewed with Burial from Asheville, North Carolina. They came up and brewed this with us back in April. So it's a mixed culture wild ale with a little bit of tartness, a little bit of funk to it. And we kind of essentially dry hopped it with flowers. So it's got black locust, elderflower, and wild rose that were foraged from North Carolina.
That's great, man. Cheers to you guys. We'll take a short break. Back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo!
Yeah.
In 1996, L. Knife & Son acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn, but has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Union Beer has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Kings County, Brooklyn, through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education on all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the 14 counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, big shout out to Union Beer Distributors, supplier of world-class ales and lagers. And I know in New York they sell Kent Falls. We're lucky to have Derek Dellinger, the brewer, here today. Derek, we're tasting one of your wild beers, Fleur de l'Amour. You made with Burial. Burial is very cool. They've been coming up a lot. They're on the show 2 weeks ago. We talked about beer trademarks, and one of the owners is an attorney. So we know them pretty well. I just want to say I love your beers, and I know that they're being handled like you're a very specialty brand out of the gate. I remember last September I was told about you guys, and we had you, and everyone loves it. I know, Anne, you carry them a lot too,
oh, yeah,
don't you?
Both places, yeah, for sure. And I think it's exciting because, you know, there's a story behind it. You can explain to someone, like, why, you know, these are foraged, like what foraged even means. I mean, I think people, customers especially, are getting way more interested in not just the beer but the backstory, and when you can talk about this is grown on the farm, this was foraged on the farm, it's not too far away.
Wait, so you guys actually have there's a farm? Yes. As part of the brewery.
Yeah, it's a very interesting setup. It's actually a three-part business. We have a functional farm that the brewery staff does not run, so that we're located on a farm. We have a farmer who runs the farm. The brewery is situated there, but we operate as an independent business. And then we also have a distillery in Portchester, New York. So the overarching idea is called the food cycle, and all these kind of, you know, businesses that feed back into each other, which is, I think, really cool.
What ingredients from the farm do you use in your beers?
So we have an acre and a half of hops. We do a hop harvest festival every September. Well, this will be the second annual one, but still going to be doing a hop harvest festival every harvest season, and making a kind of wet hopped mixed culture farmhouse ale, a little different from a lot of the IPAs and pale ales and typical hoppy things that people often use wet hops for. It's a small farm. The farm actually mostly focuses on livestock. So, other than hops, we're growing herbs and spices and other things we'll be able to use, in small ways in the beer, but it's mainly, more of a synergistic thing where, you know, we can take the spent grain from the brewing process and feed it to the animals. And there's an apple orchard that will, the fruit will mainly be going down to the distillery to make their apple brandy. So it's kind of like this, again, a cycle of feeding each business, kind of feeding into the other one.
But are you cultivating your own yeast and bacteria and things like that from,
yes,
from the farm? Okay.
Yes. So I guess that's, yeah, slightly different approach to agriculture where, yeah, I'm cultivating yeast and bacteria that, that are just harvested right off the farm. I mean, with one beer, we'll be releasing later this summer, I kind of just basically threw a bunch of things in a jar from the farm and cultured, you know, whatever came off of them and threw that in a barrel. I did the, as I was explaining before with the squash where they developed pellicle. I took squash from the farm, began lacto fermenting them like you would if you were just making a typical veggie ferment. But instead of, you know, trying to produce a pickle to eat, I wanted to steal that pellicle, that colony of yeast and bacteria, and I wanted to transplant that into a beer, essentially.
That's great. Will Stevens here is the co-founder of BeerManias.com. Will, I mean, you know, you guys have BeerManias listed, you know, all these different breweries. Hey, have you been to Kent Falls? Do you get to visit a lot of breweries? And is Kent Falls coming up as one of the more, you know, desired beers?
It's definitely a very popular one. It's definitely a personal favorite of mine. Huge fan of the beers they make. Thanks for sharing this one. It's exciting to see sour beer become so popular in general. We've definitely noticed that, and it's fun to see in the data. It's fun to see a style that I'm personally really interested in become very popular. Definitely personally curious how you got started making sour beer. I've been kind of on the fence about trying it and like a little bit scared about the having less control over the process.
I mean, I hear that all the time, and honestly, I think that fear and hesitation is almost the hardest element of making sour beer. Is, you know, so many brewers, professional included, are you know, just afraid to kind of jump into it, and it certainly does have its risks. Brettanomyces is, I don't think, is kind of formidable to sanitize as people make it out to be. It's a yeast; it can be killed just like any other yeast. It's really not that big of a deal. But the bacteria, you know, certainly are a concern. I mean, I think you go for it. If you're a home brewer, you set aside some separate equipment. It's mainly like the soft stuff, the non-stainless stuff that is harder to sanitize that you want to be careful with. So, I mean, I just started out. I got a separate auto siphon and hose and bottling bucket and, you know, all that kind of like plastic or plastic stuff that could scratch and harbor bacteria. And I just got lucky, but I never really had any issues. And I just kind of approached it like, I don't know. I mean, I'm a writer by background, so I kind of just bounce between projects and just dive into things. And I don't know. That's just my mindset, I guess. But I just kind of went for it without really dwelling on it too hard, and I think just doing that, the act of going through a few batches, kind of gets you past your concern and teaches you that it's a successful thing. And we're so, you know, it's so such a new thing that even, you know, 5 years ago when I started homebrewing, there was almost no information really, or hardly any information about doing this. So it was just like, well, I might as well be one of those guys trying it, I guess.
So when you first got into it, was it kind of fermented foods first or
Beer first? I started brewing because of bitter and esters down in Crown Heights.
Before, hi, John.
Good stuff.
Yeah. Shout out to Bitter and Esters.
Yeah, I went to a homebrewing demo they did like on Atlantic Avenue somewhere before they were even open. So I was talking to John and like arranging to get my first homebrewing kit actually before Bitter and Esters opened, and I went to visit them and buy my first kit when they were like still finishing that space. So they were awesome. They were really helpful, and they kind of gave me the push that I needed. So I homebrewed for a year or two, and then I started making like kombucha and sauerkraut and fermented beets, mainly beer and kombucha, like mainly the kind of beverage ferments. And that whole spark of learning about, like, you know, getting into sour beer, learning about lactobacillus and realizing how universal it was sort of what pushed me to, like, I mean, it definitely enhanced and pushed my sour beer brewing, and it kind of inspired me to get into all other things too.
What's the next beer? Did someone bring another beer?
Yeah, Will made a beer for us.
Yeah,
right?
Speaking of bitters and esters, I actually go there regularly to homebrew, and brought homebrew where I bought my ingredients there.
All right.
What are we doing? What's the style?
You popped up for us, Will, and then Derek. So at Jimmy's number 43 today, I tapped your dry hopped Goza.
Oh, awesome.
Tell us about that beer.
So that's a beer called Alternate World. It is a dry hop Goza. Goza's traditionally German style wheat beer brewed with salt and coriander. So that one's a sort of a contemporary take on it, where I really like the citrusy characteristics from dry hop, like, American dry hops over that kind of tart, slightly briny foundation. I think it makes for a really refreshing beer, kind of like a sour Gatorade almost.
I like Gozes a lot, and they're different than Berliner Weisses, and they shouldn't be as like assertive or citrusy. I think you did a nice job with it.
I think it's good that we're starting to see more, again, the more sour drinkers creates more easier and more affordable ways to get sour beer. And it's so nice to see this like explosion of Goza where people can go and get a six pack or, you know, have a pint of something really refreshing and sour without.
Yeah, remember last December we sat with the Grossmans from Sierra Nevada. Yeah. And they had just come out with their Goza too.
Yeah, I'm doing a beer dinner tomorrow night and that's our first course. It's the Ultra Race, we're killing it with that. Sierra it's so Nevada. Good.
It's incredible how fast the craft beer world moves, and I think it just moves faster and faster where, you know, years ago, I would hunt around New York City to find any Goza at all. I remember searching for them like 4 or 5 years ago or whatever when I wanted to brew one. And I, you know, there's like one or two German examples I could find in like the depths of the best bottle shops, and it was so hard to find. And now, you know, you can buy a dozen different
Yours is up there.
Cans.
You know, Westbrook Goza, Leipzig. But you know, it's funny. We've been sitting here. It's the middle of summer. It's July. We've been tasting, you know, lighter, dry hop beers, and all of a sudden Will opened up his growler and this dark beer came out.
Yeah, so what is
and I was
this?
Like, I haven't seen a dark beer in weeks.
Yeah, so I'm somewhat ashamed to say this is not a sour beer.
That's perfectly
I'm excited
fine.
To make the leap to try it.
Gotta have variety.
I'm going to be soon, but definitely after this conversation. But this I would describe as maybe a Cascade Dark, with the one exception to the traditional recipe being that it has New Zealand hops in it instead of just sort of Cascade. So there should be some Matsuika in the dry hop. But, yeah, it's a surprisingly light for the color beer.
It's nice. The nose is soft.
Yeah, I haven't had whatever you want to call it, a black IPA, Cascadian dark ale, or probably someone's come up with some other term at this point. One of the styles that, like, as I was just saying, like, certain things just blow up. Like, I already see Pilsners just... Everyone's like, oh, we got to do a Pilsner now. Stone's got to do a Pilsner. You know, everyone's all of a sudden latching on to the
boomerang coming back.
Yeah, whatever the hot style is, where this one kind of looked like it might do that for a little bit and then just nosedived and no one makes them anymore. But this is quite nice. This is good.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, really, Bitterness is a great place. I mean, there's not that many homebrew shops left in New York, are there?
I think that's
the only one left.
Yeah.
Well, there's some places, you know, Brooklyn Kitchen. I mean, there's some places that sell homebrew equipment. But I think he really is just they're such good people, and they really understand the culture of it and the community of it, and I think it's all-encompassing. It's just so many people out there start there. Great place.
And what's it like in Connecticut in terms of homebrewing and the brewing laws? We know that New York has really come a long way. You can homebrew, you can farm brew, you can self-distribute.
Right. Not so much in Connecticut. I mean, there's no farm brewery law. It's certainly exploding as it is in New York. And New York is doing amazing things to further the brewing scene here, as evidenced by the fact that there's like tenfold more breweries now than there were just a couple of years ago. It's a much slower explosion in Connecticut. We were the first farm brewery in the state. There's a few others opening or in the process of opening, I think, right now. But there's no statewide law or anything. The town that we're in had to essentially draft a kind of local law specifically for us. It has some room to grow. And it's, you know, it's a smaller state. There's, a bit fewer breweries there than New York, certainly. And the local area we're in, I mean, to be honest, I don't know that there is much of a homebrew scene. It's a very rural area. There's not much around. So the furthest homebrew shop is, probably 45 minutes away.
What's the reception been like on your beer? Sorry. Just like in Connecticut.
It's
tough in New York City, but like
it's always weird to think about that. I mean, I think people really like it. You know, we seem to be doing pretty well and pretty popular. I'm usually stuck in the brewery and I'm not the one driving out to accounts. But the few occasions that I do get out on delivery days, we self distribute in Connecticut, so you know our van's kind of always making the rounds and those guys are getting the feedback and getting to shake the hands and stuff. But the Connecticut beer scene is definitely like it's full of very enthusiastic people and it's growing very rapidly. And people seem really excited for what's happening.
Derek, who else? I mean, I know that just in the last year or two, there's you guys, Ken Falls, We've gotten Black Hog a lot in the city.
Yeah, yeah.
Who else can you really recommend?
Sure, yeah. I mean, Black Hog and OEC is doing really cool stuff.
Yeah.
I'm sure most people probably are familiar with them. I mean, they've definitely earned a reputation quickly, deservedly so, for doing a lot of... they're more focused exclusively on, like, sours and wild ales and blended barrel-aged beers. As their focal point, they're doing really cool things. Steady Habit, who we just packaged a collaboration with, a fruited IPA called Sparkle Boots. They're doing really great things. Some excellent IPAs. So I mean, there's definitely, like, at this point, something for everyone. There's another farmhouse brewery called Fox Farm that's opening that sounds really promising. I mean, it's definitely getting there. A lot of these breweries are still kind of like in the process of opening. So it'll be very interesting to see in like another year's time when this whole wave is kind of solidified into breweries that have beer out there.
Will, how do you guys at Beer Menus, how do you find out about new breweries? I mean, do people just submit them, or do you actually have somebody out there who's like finding them for you guys?
Yeah, it's a combination. We have a product for breweries where they can add their own information and manage it. We did actually launch a new product recently. It's a beer finder for breweries, and we're actually talking with you guys about it, but... basically, we, especially for the small self-distributed breweries, we have a tool where often if it's a brewery that's small and self-distributed, most of their accounts use Beer Menus and update all the time. So we use Beer Menus data to tell you what beers are where on the brewery website. So with that tool, we have a lot of breweries joining themselves.
That's cool, man. You guys do a lot of great stuff. We're off to a great start. Big shout out. The next three Wednesdays, I'll be at WNYC's The Green Space for Craft Beer Jam. You can check it out at thegreenspace.org. Ann was on a bunch of those with us, and some new people. We've got New Jersey versus New York, some of the emerging new breweries out of New Jersey that you don't get to see in New York. So check it out at thegreenspace.org. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right, guys. Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, check us out, heritageradionetwork.org. You can become a member. There's a lot of benefits and a lot of special activities coming up. But right now we're having our typical in-studio conversation. What are we going to drink next? Because we had – tell us again the first beer you had from Kent Falls.
So that was Florida Lamour, a wild ale that we did with Burial in Asheville. Brewed with flowers, which I had actually never done before, and I'm not sure I've had another beer with flowers.
Oh, De La Mort, like Flower of the Dead. I thought it was De La Mort, like Flower of Love.
I'm not good at French. I didn't come up with that.
Right.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question?
And what did you? We just had from you, Will.
So I brought one of my homebrewed beers using ingredients from bitters and esters, but it's a Cascade Dark that is currently only on tap at the Beer Menus office.
And then we're out of beer.
Any ideas for a name for Will's beer? Tweet us. Let's get a good name for this.
Maybe get a free beer. You know, tweet at beer underscore. If they even tweet, do people still tweet? At beer underscore sessions.
We actually maintain a page for our office where we list what beers are currently in our fridge and on tap in our kegerator. And we invite people to come by anytime. So if people have names, they can
but
come by.
Would you give us a free Beer Menus t-shirt? We'll give it out.
Sure.
Somebody tweet in, we'll get you a free Beer Menus
t-shirt. We'll figure out somehow to get it to you. I don't know. Let me ask you a question. So obviously, you know, food and I'm sorry, bread and cheese and certain fermented things we're all familiar with. But what's some of the wacky stuff? Like, what did you go out and say, I have no idea this was a fermented food. Did you try anything? I think I read something about Iceland.
Yes. Yeah. So
I mean,
fermentation can run the whole spectrum. I mean, yeah, you can have very normal things, and you know, I certainly didn't want to like push the weirdest of the weird entirely with this book, because a lot of what I wanted to do was normalize, you know, fermentation for people who have no experience with it. So you can ferment, you know, vegetables, any kind of vegetable, and some of them turn out stranger than others. Some of them turn out very good. My experience, I mean, I have kind of a bit of a texture thing where certain textures just kind of bother me in food. So, you know, I found certain things where you just expected to have a typical texture.
How about like your three, like your favorite breakfast, favorite lunch, favorite dinner? Because I'll tell you about, we Jensen Cummings,
yeah,
who does
awesome.
Brewed Food. He was here in New York, did a dinner with us. So I got a sense of what he was talking about. But your favorite breakfast, lunch, and dinner that you had in that time?
It could
be exactly the same.
I mean, a lot of lunches and a lot of dinners were the same. Favorite breakfast, I mean, I had to get pretty creative there. I would try things like sourdough kimchi pancakes and like trying to use my sourdough culture in unique ways and trying to integrate, you know, other ferments that I was doing into breakfast and trying to, some of the weirder, but still on the normal side, like experimental in that you just don't encounter them very often, but kind of normal in that they're not far off from what people normally eat. I would try and do kind of fermented smoothies. So I would take like water kefir is a type of ferment. You can ferment with these little like pods of bacteria and yeast, and kind of ferment like coconut water or just water with sugar in it. And you can ferment fruit in that or in yogurt or, you know, anything that's cultured really. And trying to get, I would try and get like a smoothie going with like oat, like fermented oats, fermented oatmeal and coconut water and yogurt and fruit and blend it
so
all together.
And like just raw milk.
You can also let raw milk clabber and start to ferment. And you can ferment any pretty much any milk with regular kefir grains, which are, you know, that's a traditional, very traditional drink that's been around for
butter.
Butter, yeah, I could do butter. I probably got a lot of calories from butter. You can get cultured butter now at most like kind of fancy grocery stores. So. Yeah, cultured
so
butter.
So your sourdough kimchi pancake, what did you put on top of it?
Well, usually cultured butter, I guess, or, you know, I'm definitely a fan of condiments, and a lot of condiments are fermented, so could have put on some kind of, like, Korean spicy, you know, red pepper fermented sauce or different things like that. Tabasco sauce is interesting, and it's, like, one of the few kind of available grocery store hot sauces, condiments that's very it hasn't changed its process since it's been made. It's fermented for like 2 years.
A lot of those foods sound familiar to me. I mean, the thing you said about bread, like giving it longer time, a real sourdough process. I mean, I like those kind of breads, and I'm not a fan of just like crappy, cheap, fast breads.
Yeah, is there any, did you find any place? So there's this place in Rome called Beer and Food. It's one of the greatest, like, you know, beer restaurants in Rome. And they have the pizza that they do is the long fermented sourdough pizza crust. And it's fantastic. But I was trying to find a place like that in New York, and I haven't found, did you find any restaurants or any markets or anything that does specifically this kind of techniques?
To be honest, I mean, there are definitely places in New York making, in New York City making really good bread now. Having been out of the city for a few years, I can't think of any.
Or in the Hudson Valley. Did you find a place that was really doing it right, or a good market or restaurant?
For bread, it's tough. Found some places in Vermont. There's like a really good bread scene in Vermont. I interview in here actually a bakery up in Vermont that I think is kind of my like platonic ideal of what a bakery should be, where they're milling their own grain and doing these long, you know, sourdough fermentations for basically every bread, and just doing everything right. They're called Elmore Mountain Bread. For some reason, Vermont just seems to be really obsessive about the quality of its food. So there's a lot up there, and there Elmore Mountain's advocating kind of like the importance of the milling process in the, you know, the steps of making bread. And that seems to be spreading within the bread world, that that aspect of bread creation is kind of gaining traction and people realizing how important that is to the process.
Sounds like you could put together a pretty good menu.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're cooking at home too, right?
That's
a lot of it goes back to home cooks and what you can do yourself.
You can make entirely fermented pizza, which, you know, fortunately was something I could eat during my year because the crust is bread, so you can do that. Cheese, mozzarella is not always fermented, but cheese obviously you can do because most cheese is fermented. And then the missing component is the tomato sauce. So I would ferment cherry tomatoes or even make tomato sauce and ferment that, and lived off a lot of pepperoni pizza that year too. So that was a popular dinner. To get back to your earlier question, I certainly had a lot of that.
But you didn't have to make everything. You could buy things too.
Yeah, I could buy
you
things.
Could buy fermented ingredients.
I mean, it would have been another almost book entirely to try and do it, making everything myself. It would have been a full-time job, maybe two full-time jobs to make everything myself. And I just didn't have
one thing. So both, you know, so Will and Ann, you guys are like high-level cicerones. You know, in that training, there's some talk of beer and food and beer and food pairings. But is there any talk about fermented foods?
Yeah, beer and food pairing is a big part of the Cicerone program. And it's also one of the most subjective parts of it. So there's a little bit of interpretation involved. But definitely a lot of people say that food that's fermented in the same way that beer is made often pairs better together than things that aren't made the same way. Did you have that experience at all?
I mean, I certainly don't have the knowledge of food and beer pairings that you do. I mean, I'm curious, actually. Like, so do they elaborate on what elements of the food? Is it the sourness? Like, is it the instead of contrasting flavors, they're complementary flavors?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I think it's largely beer and cheese that people talk about.
Okay, yeah, well, that makes sense. Yeah.
Well, it could also be fermentation flavors. Excuse me.
Right.
You know, the fruitiness, the spiciness, you know, the phenols and the esters that happen during fermentation are a lot of times words that we would use to describe food. Mm-hmm. And so there's an automatic connection, you know, with fermented flavor, also adding elements of savoriness and umami, and, you know, that aspect of food and beer work really well together. I think it's just, I just did a sour class. I just came from, you know, staff training, and one of the things I did was all sours, and we brought in different cheeses and had that together and see, like, you know, the earthiness and the funk from the yeast and the bacteria and this and that. And it really does make for a really good partner.
Yeah.
And good matches.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, cheese is so complex, and I mean, it's probably the thing that's most similar to beer in a lot of ways, in the complexity and just different flavors it can express, that it can run this whole gamut. So,
Derek, so another beer I'll have tonight at Jimmy's Number 43 is your Anachronism.
Okay.
What's that beer?
So that's kind of modeled on a style called Grätzer. It's brewed with oak smoked wheat. So traditionally it would be 100% oak smoked wheat. We do a slightly smaller percentage just to make it a little easier for us to brew, because wheat doesn't have hulls, so it'll tend to kind of form a very gummy mash. But it's brewed with this very, very cool grain. It's really not like any other smoked malt that I've brewed with. Much subtler, cleaner smoke flavor. So you get this really cool smoked beer, and it's a light beer. It's, you know, not the typical, like, kind of smoked dark ale. It's a light, farmhousey, you know, structured beer. So it's very refreshing and earthy, and the smokiness kind of comes out as this kind of rustic, you know, rustic earthy flavor, as opposed to like the barbecue-y bacon, you know, smoke flavor that you get sometimes.
And Derek, so with all these interesting styles and traditional styles and based on the farm, do you guys make an IPA too?
Oh, we do. Yeah. We have, 3 30 barrel tanks that we make a lot of the bigger, production volume stuff in, but we have a few smaller tanks, as we kind of collect our, you know, collect our fancy hops to get good contracts and so forth. So we turn out smaller volumes of our clean IPAs, but we definitely are releasing a new one every few weeks and hope to grow that in the future as we have more hops available.
Well, really, thank you that you came on. I'm looking forward to hanging out with you tonight. But Will, a quick thing. So we're talking about Cicerone tonight. We invited a number of Cicerones to our event after the show. And what's the new project you started on beermayonnaise.com?
Yeah, so on my end, I took the exam last December, and once I passed it, reached out to the Cicerone program. I was really excited about it all. I thought it was very valuable for everyone to go through, and we have since started doing monthly webinars where we invite anyone who wants to come out, and we have members of the Cicerone team go through a different topic each month, and On beer menus on the blog, you can find out how to sign up and subscribe, but we have one next Tuesday with Ray Daniels, the director of the program, talking about draft service. And yeah, it's really exciting. It's a program where it's very daunting to get into it. It can feel like a lot to prepare for the exams, and we've found that just sort of going face-to-face with the team behind the program is very valuable to help people.
So maybe my staff, if they're not willing to sit down and go through the Cicerone program, they could start by checking out your webinars.
Yep. Every show we record, so your team can listen to it on their own time if they want to. Yeah. Hopefully it helps people get prepared.
That's great. Anything else you guys want to add before we close out?
Well, I guess, whoever's listening, look up the book, because there's something about decaying shark meat or something, a cool story that we don't have time for now.
Didn't get to that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's okay, but it looks like something really cool, so I'm excited to check out this book.
So tell us again, it's Derek Dollinger,
yep.
The Fermented Man.
The Fermented Man, it comes out next week, actually, so you'll be able to, you can order it right now on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. It'll be in bookstores next week, and you can follow me online. I'm on Twitter, bear-flavored, bear like the animal. Yeah.
Nice.
Right on.
And we know Will's got doing Cicerone webinars and a lot of cool stuff at Beer Menus. Again, someone tweet us about something, you'll get a free Beer Menus t-shirt.
Twitter's been replaced by Pokemon Go now.
Pokemon Go.
Oh my God, that. Enough with the Pokemon.
And it's July Good Beer Month in New York City and the areas, and it's informal. It's like an open source thing that's been going for years. But check it out, julygoodbeermonth.com. And next week we're going to announce some of the new Good Beer Seal Bar winners. And, this is a great time to tune in to Heritage Radio Network, right, Ann?
Having some fun.
And next week we're airing our special record at Treadwell Park with Tomei Arthur and
Olivier from Brasserie DuPont.
That was a fun show.
That was really cool. That guy's a genius.
That was one of our first kind of like add another bar with a full kind of recording setup, and David, the engineer, was there. And that's next Tuesday, July 19th, all right, at 5 o'clock on Heritage Radio Network. In closing, I'd like to thank our sponsors at Union Beer Distributors who have helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. Thanks to Derek, Will, and Ann for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Maggie Seiden and Justin Kennedy, and our engineer, David Tadashur. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right, yeah, woo!
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.